Hey everyone, it's Nate here again. Just wanted to remind everyone listening that this is actually episode 294 from the delay a few weeks ago. Next week we should be coming out with a new episode, and then the episode after that is 295. And then after that we are coming out, it's going to be normal shows again every 2 weeks. So apologies for the mix-up in that little the number game here, but we'll be back on track in a couple of weeks. I also wanted to remind everyone to go to www.truetolife.us, and that's to register for Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk's True to Life seminar, which is coming up February 19th. It's a Sunday next year, and it's an all-day seminar with Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk presenting on their series called True to Life. I'm going to be there in person. I'm really looking forward to meeting people who are going to be there in person, but I'm also going to be looking forward to seeing you there virtually. I'll be there helping set things up. So www.truetolife.us. Enjoy the episode this week and have a wonderful holiday. And I will talk to you guys next episode. This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. And my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
Good.
Cold.
Yeah, gee, everything's fine out here in Elk Grove.
And Southern California, too.
You guys live in warm places. I'm facing down a long, cold winter.
Well, and yep. Dr. Hawk, you told me that in appreciation for the podcast, you've had to turn off your heater just while we're recording. Is that right?
Yeah, I normally have a little radiant heater under my desk to keep my feet warm, and it's going to make a lot of background noise. So I turned it off so I can freeze for the art here.
Yeah, there you go. that's good.
I hope that's appreciated.
Well, listeners, pay attention to see what Dr. Hawk does for you and your comfort.
Well, it's also what she does for herself, because her own self-esteem mechanism, you know, is more proud of herself for the suffering.
I do.
Surviving.
I do. I basically feel like Tolstoy writing War and Peace by candlelight.
That's great. Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, what's happening, Nathan?
Well, we've got some questions today. And, well, the first one is, you know, it's a term that I heard a lot when I was going to college and even after college. It's a, you know, we'll probably end up getting into some politics, Dr. Hawk. So, you know, brace yourself, especially with the election that just, I guess, do we have the results yet? Or we're getting close. I don't know. Who the hell knows?
It's election month now.
Yeah. But the question is, dear doctors, could you please discuss cultural appropriation, especially with regards to not sporting wigs, etc.? I, for one, really admire when people dress up like people from my culture and use the same hair and face accessories, even though in the past we were under colonial rule and oppression. Now, just a little background. This is the end of the question, but I did some digging because I couldn't find a cultural appropriation. All I could find was a Wikipedia definition of cultural misappropriation. And so what I found there was the inappropriate or unacknowledged adoption of an element or elements of one culture or identity by members of another culture or identity. Especially controversial when there's a dominant culture. So
this all sounds like a bunch of leftist academia, even the whole idea. But so we'll let our resident
leftist academia.
Yeah, exactly. Academician.
Your former academic anthropologist.
Yes, exactly. We'll let you wind out.
Well, it's funny to hear Nate ask the question because it's such a concept that is just, you know, I'm not surprised at all that somebody's asking about it. It's a concept that's been around for a long time and has been a sort of, you know, wielded and weaponized, as the kids like to say, for a long time as well. So whenever I think of cultural appropriation or misappropriation or whatever we want to call it, I always think of the Yale Halloween crisis, which was quite a while ago. It was pre-Trump, sometime pre-Trump. So this was when Nicholas Christakis, who you guys might know, was a professor at Yale, might still be a professor at Yale, and his wife was working as kind of one of the resident deans in the student housing, some capacity in student housing. And she sent an email, like a campus-wide email, because there had been some complaints about, there had been leading up to Halloween, you know, warnings of don't appropriate my culture, don't put on a wig or a costume that makes me feel offended because you're misrepresenting my cultural history, etc. And so Christakis's wife, whose name is Erica, sent out this email that said essentially, we're all adults here, and we can all make responsible choices about our Halloween costumes, and we don't need to police what we're doing. And people can be trusted to wear whatever they want to wear for Halloween. And if someone's offended, they can be trusted to deal with their offense on their own terms. It was this very sort of sharp angle.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's Halloween. People are going to be maybe offended by costumes, but you're grown up, so it's okay. You don't need to come crying to mommy and daddy government about it. And this was a huge cluster. I mean, it was, and this was probably about 10 years ago. It was just this huge crisis. I think she was fired, or she, at least not in that position anymore. He was, you know, there are videos of this online. It's sort of like the Evergreen State College crisis, where there are these mobs of students just wailing and sobbing and like feeling, you know, like these are Yale undergrads saying that they feel that they've never been more oppressed. You know, here they are in these halls of incredible privilege and access and power. And this is like the worst thing that they can find to complain about. And it's really preemptive. I don't think it was in response to any particularly offensive costume. I think it was just, it's Halloween and every year I have to fight for my right to not have my culture appropriated.
Incredible.
So yeah, this has been going on for a long, long time. It's of a piece with how people get all riled up during the holiday season around certain holiday songs, like how rapey "Baby It's Cold Outside" is. Oh, you know, it's like these are the things. Yeah. These are the things that sort of become these flashpoints. And obviously, there are cultural appropriation issues outside of Halloween, but it does tend to kind of focus around that. So yeah, this is just, you know, call it what you will, sort of oppression Olympics, etc.
Mm-hmm, right.
This is something that becomes salient only in an environment where people are living in such unacknowledged privilege that you have to source a new thing to be upset about and a new thing to derive some status behind. That's all it is. So this questioner, like, you know, is many others pointing out that, hey, I don't personally find it offensive. I actually appreciate it when people acknowledge my cultural legacy. And that's the environment that I grew up in. Mm-hmm. In the 80s and 90s, you know, we had sort of, you know, weeks at school where every day was linked to a different cultural tradition, and we'd eat that kind of food and we'd wear those kinds of costumes.
Sure.
And it was like this celebration of multicultural, i.e. melting pot kind of idea.
Yeah.
And that has now totally turned around, where now it's very problematic with a capital P to engage cultural issues in that way on that level. And of course, there's no correct way to do it. You're wrong. No matter which way you turn on this question, you're wrong if you don't acknowledge cultural difference. You're wrong if you acknowledge it too much or in the wrong way. When really the reality of it is, as Doug said at the outset, this is sort of a leftist academic thing. You know, I think most people who are finding their culture represented or misrepresented in whatever way are actually not taking that much offense. The offense is only being had by a vocal minority. So,
yep.
Yeah.
That's what it shows with the, you know, the Florida State Seminoles and the Atlanta Braves, for God's sakes. How much more respectful can you be than calling somebody a brave? The but no, we're gonna be very upset about this.
Right, they must not have been in the military here about Apache helicopters and Blackhawks, you know.
Yeah, Apache helicopter. There you go. We can't call it that.
This is pretty incredible.
But this goes down to something that Jen and I talked through and sort of use as a plumb line in our other work that we do on perverse incentives, which is that, you know, this gets born in academia and grows up like a little strong little seedling into a sapling, into a big mighty oak. And it wouldn't have happened unless you had unless there was not a point to this that sooner or later you could leverage this to get money. So somewhere inside of this thing is the moral high ground leveraging its way, smelling that when you have a big, fat, completely corrupt federal government, that there is a way to bitch that you are the oppressed, and in some fashion, you are going to wind up potentially better off. And then there's the brokers that surround it too, that are whipping it up, and all the sociology professors at Swarthmore. And so, I don't think that actually would have taken place had you not had essentially a massive public trough from which there would be a bunch of piranhas there looking to get it. I don't think that would have taken place in this culture without that fact. I think that I'm not saying that in the minds of every single individual that has been involved in this fiasco for the last 50 years that is conscious or that it's even in their heads, but that connection is in enough heads, consciously and unconsciously, to actually have driven this phenomenal, you know, a cultural phenomenon, that we now see today of a bunch of people complaining about everything. It's amazing.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Dr. Love, because I've always considered these kinds of things, these ploys, as very childish. And last show, we talked about what do you do with an unruly child who's acting out and acting super childish. And you basically said, like, they're angling from some sort of resources that they feel is unfair. And I'm just so glad that you tied it around, that this makes perfect sense. Yep. There's some sort of payoff at the end.
Well, I didn't figure it out. The brilliant Dr. Jen Hawk figured this out. That's what her dissertation is involved here. But this is, I think that, I mean, what's your take, Jen? I mean, you think this thing ever gets any legs behind it anywhere without that possibility?
No. Well, I cut out there for a second. So I missed the beginning of the how you wound up there, but I think I got the gist. No, I think this starts like so many other things start with good intentions gone haywire and awry. Because obviously, you know, again, growing up in the 80s and 90s, there were horrifically grotesque representations that did deserve to be retired.
Right.
And, you know, there were really, really just racist imagery and certain names. And we can argue about, you know, the Braves or, you know, that was my middle school mascot was the Braves in Wasilla, Alaska, which is a little a little silly. My high school was the Warriors with, you know, the chieftain on the side of the school. And I don't know if they've actually repainted that at this point. They probably have. And those were far from the most offensive, you know, but they were, I think there's a conversation warranted about that kind of thing and whether it's appropriate or whether it's being, you know, it's just being overused or misused. And a lot of Halloween costumes in that era as well were sort of over the top and blackface and offensive. And, you know, people would think nothing about all kinds of things that I think you can make a legitimate claim are not ideal and likely to be offensive. And so there was sort of this learning curve where people had to kind of recalibrate and educate themselves and understand that, okay, I'm a teenage girl and maybe it's not the greatest idea in the world to be wearing this, you know, sort of Native American headdress to my Halloween party. Mm-hmm. out here in Fairbanks, Alaska. But I think at the same time, two things happened. One is the access to resources that you're talking about, and therefore the incentive structure that, right. that leads people into sort of a race to being offended. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, also related to that public trough and the agents on the other side. What did you call them? The sociology professors at Swarthmore. What did you gave them a moniker?
I don't know.
The people who were whipping up the right. the frenzy and encouraging it.
They're basically brokers that side, and pillage.
The brokers yeah. of outrage. So right. so on that side of the equation, that there's also a market process behind that where they are incentivized to move the whole system away from personal responsibility, where it's like, you know, hey, buddy, you're wearing a Halloween costume I find offensive, or you know, I find your mascot of your sports team offensive, and so I'm gonna launch a letter writing campaign, or I'm gonna draw some public attention to the cause and see what the market will do in response to it, or work this out on an individual level because somebody I'm going to school with has offended me and I want them to know about that, and that's as far as it's going to go. I'm not then going to escalate to the president of Yale for compensation for damages to my esteem or whatever it is that they're going yeah. after.
So we're going to fire some lady.
Yeah, we're going to and yeah, there has to be blood for this offense. So it's kind of this, it's both that there are people who are incentivized to be offended, and then there are people who are also incentivized to move the conflict out of the realm where all conflicts like this should be settled, right. and take it into the administrative state as well. So the administrative bureaucratic monster benefits on both sides. It's yeah. it's incentivizing the behavior and it's incentivizing the brokers to continue brokering
yes.
it. And it just spirals and spirals and spirals.
Of course.
And then, you know, other people get a whiff of, oh, well, there were some wages of outrage assigned to this marginalized group. And
right.
so how can I identify myself as also a member of a marginalized group, or, you know, how can I get a piece of this? And I don't see that logic dissipating anytime soon. I see it only continuing to metastasize out of control right in front of us. And social media obviously has thrown gas on the bonfire.
I remember when imitation was considered the sincerest form of flattery, but now it's like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, very true. And actually, I remember, you know, the Washington Redskins had a crisis here the last two or three years, and they have to change themselves to the Washington Commanders. Last year, they were the Washington Football Team because they couldn't figure out what they were going to call themselves. But survey research showed that the Native American tribes weren't at all offended by this.
Especially if they win.
Yeah, particularly, but I mean, they just don't. And but this wound up, the brokers smell blood. And
right,
you know, that's
right.
that. You can
well,
forget it.
They smell blood in the sense that there's actual monetary gain behind it for them and job security. But then there's also status. There's virtue
oh, yes,
signaling
huge.
All the way down on this. And so this reminds me a lot of the Jason Riley's book, Please Stop Helping Us. Like if that data is true, that the sort of tribes in question were, you know, adequately surveyed and weren't offended, that's a really interesting example of virtue signaling white people who
yes.
are fighting this fight on behalf of the downtrodden, on behalf of the offended. And that is a huge, huge piece of so much of this, not just in this realm, but so much of what we see just in kind of leftist offense politics and cancel politics in general, where it's this runaway process of in-group signaling about how much you care about the plight of these people that you want to help because you're an agent for their offense, because presumably they can't advocate for themselves, or they're laboring under some kind of Marxist false consciousness and they don't really know that they should be offended. I mean, people will make these arguments with straight faces. They'll say, you know, like the, often in a very racist way, ironically, you know, how the kind of critiques that we'll get of Clarence Thomas being an Uncle Tom, for example, those are always coming from the left side of the political spectrum. So, there have been some really powerful critiques of this process, and the one that comes to mind is Riley's book. So if people are interested in this topic, that's a wonderful place to start. Please stop helping us.
There you go.
Yeah. Wow. And for listeners who are listening, who wanted to hear more, Dr. Hawk, your podcast is Hawk Block, but also known as Perverse Incentives. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. Well, for exactly this reason, we're sitting here talking about all these perverse incentives in this kind of manufactured marketplace. So, yeah, Doug and I periodically rant about politics, and identity politics is a big part of that, and topics like this. So, yeah, that's always. Although we've just received another strike on YouTube, so we've now moved that pretty much exclusively to
badge of honor.
Patreon and Odyssey will be, if there are public episodes, they'll be searchable in Odyssey.
Every time I seem to question the utility of a medication for a certain problem, we wind up with a strike.
Yeah. We really can't be questioning, certainly not making any sweeping statements against the effectiveness and safety of this medication/treatment. But also, even bringing it into question apparently is enough to get us a strike. So. Yeah. Yeah, we're not looking toward YouTube as any kind of sustainable place to put our stuff anymore.
Fair enough.
So, yeah.
All right, Nathan, what else we got?
All right, our next question. Dear doctors, are men now, in a world where women also make a lot of money, willing to sleep down if they themselves don't make much money?
I think that essentially all people all the time, their job is to manage their time and energy in pursuit of the resources that they value. And so if you're in a situation where, a huge dynamic in human life is males hustling to get resources to provision females. And those that hustle more effectively are able to increase their marketability to females. And therefore, you know, the guy who does better, who's a better hunter, is going to wind up a little bit more rewarded by female interest than the guy who isn't as good. And that will translate into men that make more money than other men will, on average, wind up with people that are more attractive than they would have otherwise, obviously. So in other words, all this is to say is that the female brain is sensitive to the male's ability to acquire resources, and that impacts her mating choices, okay? So it's not a question of whether they're willing to sleep down. It's market forces, since females are driving, you know, mate choice more than men, or as much as men, certainly. So Miller would argue that females are effectively, fundamentally, the gatekeeping force in human mating decisions, predominantly, and so. If depending on, you know, quote, men that don't make much money relative to whom, okay, so it all has to do with, obviously, so in a culture where females in general are making quite a bit of money and therefore they are not in need of the provisioning as acutely, then we can expect that the males will have that aren't making as much money will have that force their choices lower. And so that it isn't that they're willing to, it's that they don't have any choice. Their choice is to no mate or a mate that's less fancy. That's all that's how that's going to go down.
Got it.
I think that's, does that sound about right, Jen?
Yeah, I think so. It's an interesting, it's an odd way to frame the question because, yeah, it's, they're going to be in that situation regardless of whether the women are making more money or not. If they're making less money relative to other men, they have to, right, quote unquote, sleep down, right, because they're just not as competitive unless they are, you know, women who are economically self-sufficient are, they're looking to his income for sure. They're really looking more at his income potential, because income is just a proxy for his general provisioning capacity. So, you know, if he's sort of hasn't hit it big yet financially, but he's very, you know, she detects a lot of potential and a lot of potential hustle in him and is excited by that. Just because he doesn't have a lot of zeros in his bank account, he might still outrank somebody who technically has more money but doesn't show the same kind of potential for a long-term pair bond, because she's sort of calculating over the long haul here. Right. And, you know, money is just a symbol for what it is that she really wants to see in him, because obviously we don't have bank accounts in the Stone Age, so right, she's looking for, right, for the capacity to provision her and for good decision making and decisiveness that benefits them both, and leadership and all the stuff that she wants. And so it's not necessarily what's in his bank account if he's bringing a lot of other things to the table. So I wouldn't want people to get hyper focused on that if they're an otherwise good candidate. Yeah.
I.e. that they're doing an amazingly comprehensive assessment. And your financial circumstances at any given moment in time are just an estimate of that component of the assessment. That's all they are. You know, they have practical consequences, but nevertheless, as Jen's talking about, the female should be calculating the provisioning capacity, you know, in terms of relationship across the length of a theoretical relationship. So,
Exactly. Like a really easy, simple example of this is, like, you know, one guy is he's selling cars and he's making great commission and he's got a lot of money to throw around, and he's one contender. And then the other guy, you know, just got out of med school and is deep in debt, and, you know, he's in the process, and she's not looking at immediately, okay, what kind of fancy date or fancy car or fancy situation can Mr. Car Salesman offer me right now compared to this guy who's in a longer term investment process, who maybe is temporarily underwater and even has a lot of debt. But I'm going to go ahead and place my bets on him, all things equal, because I'm looking at different signals of what this guy's chops are and how intelligent he is and how respected he's going to be in the community, and also in at some level the amount of vegan bacon he's going to be able to, right, bring home over the course of this relationship.
So women are just venture capitalists, yeah, is what they are.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. No, they are
exactly what they are.
Yep.
SRADs, senior resource acquisition devices.
Sophisticated resource acquisition devices.
All right.
So, Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle,
what else we got?
Well, yeah, I just had a hypothetical situation that I apologize if this doesn't make a lot of sense, but I'm going to give it a shot. So, I'm thinking from our last question, if, you know, the resource acquisition becomes a game of who can, you know, become the most oppressed person. And of course, I can't imagine there's, you know, the evo psyche of a female is very attracted to that. But I wonder how that plays a role if, you know, if you've got the most successful male who's able to play that game appropriately. How does that fly in terms of actually having those attractive characteristics? So they can acquire resources by playing the game, but it's not really an attractive game to play. I don't know if that's making any sense at all.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Joel, go ahead, John. What are you thinking?
That's generally a like attracts like. I mean, playing that game is a competitive avoidance strategy. It's a hey, I can't compete fairly, so this looks like a better bet for me.
Oh, okay.
And so you know, if he's in a position where he can win it fair and square, then he stands to gain a lot more status, a lot more self-esteem for himself, and a lot more esteem from her by doing it that way. If he chooses the other strategy because he feels competitively cornered and he's in a mediocre competitive position, that's the type of female he's going to attract as well. So because a female who has options, who are quote unquote doing it the right way, and acquiring real status in the marketplace, is not going to esteem the sort of
complainer,
outrage chaser, in the same way that she would esteem someone who's gotten there through hard work and fair competition.
So you're saying women really are the bedrock of civilization? Okay, okay.
you could say that. yeah. Thank you. You have other thoughts on that, Doug?
No, that was great.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah. All good. All right. What else we got?
But it
Nathan?
Is yeah, go ahead. It's an assortative mating question. So it's actually really interesting sociologically, because there are entire sort of domains of the mating world at this point where the competitive victimhood is the coin of the realm for both the men and the women, and those are depressing places to hang out.
Yeah,
Dr. Hawk, do you notice these type of you know, in-group, out-group fighting with those types of personalities? I just don't know how female dynamics works that well. Obviously, I'm still single, but you know what I mean. So it's...
I really don't know
what do you mean
means.
In-group, out-group? Yeah.
Oh, maybe I'm saying specifically the wrong words. I'm saying is, you know, you obviously have a personality that esteems people for appropriate, you know, non-complaining, mongering, brokering behavior.
I.e. competitive success.
Competitive success.
And actually, all females are built that way.
Oh.
Okay?
Yeah.
So the only question is, though, that if you're a female who yourself is either complaining or is highly sensitive tribally to, because you majored in sociology at Swarthmore, and because you're a trust fund child that isn't going to have to work for a living. So as a result, God knows you didn't want to have to take chemistry or physics or anything like that. So you just took, you know, women's studies and you know, I'm not sure what else, Jen.
Underwater basket weaving was always.
Yeah, things like that.
Interpretive dance. Yeah.
interpretive dance. That's good. So I forgot where I was going with this, but if that's who you are, then you've you're also soaking in, as Jen called it, the coin of the realm, which is to be to be sensitive to you. Part of your virtual signaling is to be sensitive to the oppressed, and so therefore you're probably more likely to be listening and nodding. And if some guy is handsome and broke, but he's got some little oppressed markings, you know what I mean, on his face paint, then that
cultural appropriation, by the way.
Oh yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, talking about face paint. It's get an inappropriate buzzer for you, sir.
They painted those faces in Scotland, according to Mel Gibson. They paint them in Africa, and they paint
well,
them
Mel
here
Gibson
in the
is cultural,
United States.
Mr.
Where
cultural
didn't they
appropriation.
Paint them? You know.
She can make her bed with that kind of settling for that sort of deal, but that is a very unstable equilibrium for her, because she is going to be resentful of his inability to provision her. It's going to become a competitive dynamic, because it's going to be who's the bigger victim in this relationship. And that puts her in a weird role as a female, where she's constantly having to reassure him and comfort him and let him know that he's, you know, admired and appreciated, even though he's given her nothing to genuinely admire or appreciate.
Wow.
And so that whole thing is just rotten to the core, and is going to be a really unhappy dynamic for both of them in the long term.
Wow.
God, I swear I've seen that in my practice. I just can't remember where, but
I've seen
sure
it.
Yeah. I have.
The movie Forrest Gump and that girl Jenny, I think that's what comes to
mind.
Jenny.
Yeah. Yeah. Jenai was not going to authentically esteem Forrest as much as she loved him and, you know, found value in him. That's not a potential mate for her. And she knew it. And
whereas the Black Panther party, yeah, that was everything she wanted. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Movie would not get made today for so many reasons. That movie could not be made today. Yeah. But yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. It was only, 30 years ago.
Yeah. Well, all right. What else we got, Nathan?
All right. Dear Doctors, in episode 288, you talked about how one might stumble into a dream job, and you exposed the dynamics that would have likely taken place. Could you help us get some idea of how young people in their 20s can increase the likelihood of stumbling into a well-fitting job?
Go ahead, Jen.
Stumble more.
What's that?
Just do more stumbling.
Yeah, sure.
There's really only one answer to this. I mean, it's Doug has used the analogy before of, you don't know what kind of ice cream flavor you like until you've tried the different ice cream flavors. Like you have to, there is a process where I always, whether we're talking about a 20-year-old trying to stumble into their ideal job or we're talking about a 60-year-old empty nester who is mm-hmm. trying to figure out what she wants to be when she grows up. It's the same process. And I always tell people that it's actually you're more ruling things out than ruling them in many cases. So, you try things, you experiment with things. And so many people are kind of afraid because they're like, well, what if it's not right? And what if I don't like the job? And they forget that that's a really important process of the calibration and education process that you're in. You are actually discovering what it is that you don't like as much as you're discovering what you do like. And as you discover what you don't like and what you do like, you start making general inferences that continue to fine tune where you're going to stumble next. So maybe you start stumbling randomly at the beginning because you really don't know. There are just so many different things that seem like they might be a good idea, but very quickly you start to build up associations. So you're in the ice cream shop and you tried raspberry and you really didn't like it. So you're going to guess that you probably are not going to like boysenberry either because it's probably pretty similar. Mm-hmm. So instead, maybe you're going to go for like a mint chip or something. And that is what this is like. You are just trying different things, trying different environments. You're going to pick up things that you're not even aware of, especially when we're talking about a young person like this. Mm-hmm. Certain type of work environments are going to be really good for you and others are not. So you might think that you would love a job where you work remotely and you don't have a lot of supervision, but you might learn if you have that kind of job that it's really hard for you to stay on track and be productive and meet your goals, that you need a little more structure. And then you take another job that has too much structure. And so you have to find the happy medium there. So when we've talked about this before, we've talked about the lost art of internships and volunteering and just kind of, getting a sense of what might be interesting and going and knocking on some doors and saying, hey, can I work for you for free or for minimum wage for a month or two and just kind of see how I like this and how this feels and not be afraid to cut your losses and move on when you discover it's not the right fit. The odds that you go out there and the first job you get is your dream job are very, very low. It's going to be a journey of discovering a lot of different things.
Yeah, I can remember. I don't remember the circumstances, but for some reason, I poked my head in the door or I do not remember how this happened, but I wound up at some moment for a few minutes at the Darden School, the business school at the University of Virginia.
Oh, God.
And the psychology department is what you'd expect out of a social sciences department. All the professors are walking around in jeans and flannel shirts and if they could, if it was warm enough, they'd wear Birkenstocks. But, that's not what they were in. Okay. And that's whether they're men or women, this is what it is. And that's the psychology department. And it was all fun. And I was perfectly comfortable there. The Darden School, I poke my head in, everybody's dressed up like they're on Wall Street in class. Okay. And it's very competitive. And like the professors ask questions, and the guy's making it in his answers. It's a little presentation. Some guy with a really crisp crew cut and, you know, big upper body strength and, clean shaven. I mean, he's ready to go make his six figures. You know what I mean? As soon as school's out, as soon as the school bell rings, that's what it looked like. It was amazing. I thought, Wow. I didn't know behavior genetics then, but I saw what this is completely different than the psychology department, you know? And so there you have it.
And you perceived in a million different little observations that you couldn't even identify if we gave you a pad and paper to write them down. You were making all these little inferences about, I don't think I fit in.
No
way. I
don't
think this is my place.
There's no way in
I don't
hell.
Think these are my people. And I don't think I could be competitively successful here because this would demand behaviors and, just to fit in, I'd have to change my behaviors in certain ways that I'm not comfortable doing, and let alone be sort of triumphant and make a mark for myself. I have really similar experience. When I loved working in the Alaska State Legislature, also kind of Birkenstocks and flannel territory, and, answering constituent calls and working on legislation research and in a very small kind of cozy office environment, and then went to go intern in the U.S. Senate. And those people were insane. It was like all the guys were date rapist douchebags. All the women were like incredibly competitive. Everybody was really dressed up. It was, and I had this feeling, even as a, I was just a kid, I was 19 years old, but I had this feeling that, there was a lot more mating display than anything else going on. I didn't have that language at the time, but it felt like the whole thing was about how people looked, how they talked to each other, and then, what they did after work, what bars they went out to, who hooked up with whom, et cetera. And I just was like, God, this isn't what I thought it would be. I thought it would just be what I was doing in the Alaska legislature, but more so. And it's actually a completely different thing. And this is not my thing. Like, I don't want to swim in this water. But if I had calculated it on paper and done some kind of what color is your parachute kind of thing, like it would have been, oh, well, I really like politics and I really like working. But it was actually the environment that I was working in, the types of the type of work, but also the environment and the people and the just the whole structure of what that looked like. And it was a completely different situation. So, you have to encounter those things in person to discover how they feel to you. You can't intellectualize your way into this. So that's why, people should just, especially someone in their 20s, just try stuff, stumble.
Yeah, because it's going to be, there's going to be several, all these features that Jen's just talking about. Number one, I knew that I wasn't going to make my, if you think through the principle of energy conservation, which is the epicenter of all motivation and all architecture of all life, all features of all life. So the idea is, how am I going to translate the time and energy that I have on this earth in order to optimize gene survival? And so, you might say, well, why aren't you donating to a sperm bank? And the answer is that the reason is that the architecture of motivation is designed to give you feedback about sub-goals. It couldn't care less about the goal. So the goal is, there is no euphoria when a woman who even wants to have a child with her husband or mate at the process of an hour or so of when conception takes place. She has no awareness of it at all. She's not designed for that to be a rewarding process. She's designed with sensitivities to certain organism environment circumstances that are cued to indicate increases or decreases of gene survival. So she's meeting handsome guy, kissing handsome guy, having him, make all kinds of pair bond noises, great sex. These are the sub-goals that the system evolved to be sensitive to. And so your goal in life is to optimize the sum total of the sub-goals. It is not, and that is actually what your motivational architecture is. even your conscious awareness of what your motivation is. You are not actually motivated to pursue gene survival per se. Although you can imagine that you have the capability of having children and you might want to have one, fair enough. But the point of all this is that what an animal is doing and what it's doing is it's using its brain in order to calculate the optimum use of its time and energy across essentially estimated budgets of time and energy. And so as I poked my head in the Darden School class, I'm looking at this thinking, okay, is this the very best use of my time and energy in order to demonstrate my abilities and trade with the village as optimally as possible? And the answer is no. Just like Jen had the chops to compete in Washington, she didn't want to. It's like she knew these are, as we say, date rape douchebags. It's like, and I'm looking at the Darden School, it's like, really? A bunch of thick-necked guys with you know, probably 10 IQ points less than I have are going to be arguing about whose business model is better and what the customer will likely have and then how we can franchise it. And it's like, really?
Ugh, gross.
I couldn't care less. And the truth is you can frickin' have it. You can have the whole frickin' enchilada. I couldn't give a rat's ass about this. Okay, so and that's because my brain said, no, this brain is built for different things. It has, you know, it has deep interest in other processes. And therefore, I have to search out those because that's going to be ultimately, if there's ever going to be any display gold for me, it's going to be there. It's going to be the biggest thing that I'm going to be able to bring the village is going to be trying to figure out these kinds of problems. If I was super gifted with my hands and really interested in biological mechanics, you know, and really smart, then I would have been a surgeon. Okay? So what we find is that, and then Jen was talking about something else, that essentially these two issues wed when it comes to finding your career. Number one, it's figuring out what kinds of problems you inherently like to solve. And when we say problems, other people have needs, and it's our job to try to figure out what needs of those that we can fill. And of course, I could learn to be a plumber and snake out people's drains, but that's pretty simple relative to what my brain's capable of figuring out. So therefore, I should be trying to figure out, you know, can I solve problems if I'm 7'2" and I can jump really well and I'm 24 years old and I'm coordinated? Trust me, I'm going to be trying to make the NBA. And so what's the problem I'm trying to solve? Well, I'm trying to get a bunch of resources. I'm trying to display my athleticism. And believe it or not, if I can do it well and a bunch of people cheer, I'm getting one of those intermittent sub-goal evidence that I'm valuable from the village. Okay, players don't want to play in front of no audience. It's not inspiring to them. They want to play in front of that audience because they're designed by nature for audience approval to be part of the sub-goals, just like kissing is to two people that are falling in love. Same thing. So so in essence, it's finding out what your niche is likely to be, your best niche, that general area. And then second of all, it's the social ecology of your life is the most important thing that determines your happiness. So if you love whatever it is, but it turns out the first place you stick your nose in, they are doing the processes that you're interested in, but there's a real shithead in charge and it's really a bad shop, then don't give up on that genre of work. Just go try it again somewhere else under somebody else. Okay? See if it changes remarkably when we get better personalities. So that's kind of, you know, that's the notion. We have to, the social ecology, ultimately, we're seeking a really good social ecology. But finding that social ecology is partially determined on, do we have people that are interested in the things that we're interested in? So can we join them? And is it, you know, in other words, does the general thing fit? Do they fit? Does the process that I'm trying to bring to the village and give them fit my personality? And can I join with people in that process? Because it's not likely to be solitary. So if I'm a surgeon and I love to do surgery, you want to work at a hospital with a surgical team you really like. Okay, so that's the notion. It's a two-part question, but you know, it's worth knowing that it's a two-part question so that you can diagnose better, you know, what might be missing.
There's one thing that this brings up, and kind of it brings us back to the beginning and the first question with the cultural appropriation question. Yeah. There's a trap here, and it's the, instead of genuinely making that analysis of the match for any particular environment and position, you crash your ships on the rocks of false status through a victim strategy. And so you walk into a situation that you look at that thing and you say, well, I don't think this is the best and highest use of my talents, and probably because I've overshot it a little bit, and I don't think I could actually be competitively successful here, which, you know, if I'm being super honest, might have been part of my logic with DC, might have been part of your logic with the business school, might have been like, i.e., I can probably be successful, but I'd have to work a lot harder than and do things that don't come as naturally, and you know, it just doesn't feel like that's going to be the best use of my time. Where in that case, for me, it would have been, and I've been in this situation many times in my life, where it's like, well, go ahead and go into that competitive realm, but you know, highlight the fact that you're oppressed somehow. So in my case, in the 90s, you know, just being a white female was sufficient for your oppression. So it's like, oh, well, we're underrepresented. We're underrepresented in the U.S. Senate. We're underrepresented as staff. You know, I'm going to make my presence here more about that than it is about, you know, what I'm actually genuinely contributing to the village. And this is such a predominant incentive for so many people that they're just not even attuned to it right now. So for somebody, mm-hmm. particularly in their 20s, if you have some kind of salient feature that makes you a member of an oppressed class or a potential member of an oppressed class, you're going to have to be doubly sensitive to that trap, because I have clients who have essentially found themselves they're able to look outside in at the fact that they are in this trap and they're miserable because they recognize that they've basically become a token employee, and they hate it, and they don't respect themselves and they don't respect their coworkers, because they sort of are like, well, you don't respect me, why should I respect you? There's no respect, there's no esteem anywhere, and the whole thing is just absolutely shitty. But it becomes this sort of complete trap for people, because it's very easy, and you know, there's the financial compensation is good, and it's like, it's pseudo esteem, it's like likes on Instagram. So for somebody who is just starting off and trying to figure out where they fit in the world, you're going to need to be sensitive about that and avoid it, even though it's not going to feel necessarily like the right thing to do. There's a reason we call the show Beat Your Genes. You know,
yes.
if you want long-term happiness, you might need to trade off the short-term promise of something like that.
Yeah, i.e., yeah. You know, not worth it unless you earn it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And the energy conservation that's dangling in front of you is going to be tempting. Right. No question.
It's very tempting.
Yeah.
Very tempting, and people will be applauding you for even thinking about it.
Yes. Got it. Wow. What a mess, Jen. I'm so glad you're writing those chapters.
Which book is this?
Yeah.
It's kind of like looking at subatomic particles, where it just gets more complicated and more the connections and it's like it gets harder to pin down the more you look at it, because it's in everything. It's just all the connections are so deep and everything is rotten to the core.
Yes.
So yeah. Everybody's got perverse incentives.
Yes. And then it, as we're as we'll explain in the tome we are in fact writing, which hopefully you can tell from this discussion, that it starts to percolate down into
the core of it winds up being deception, and deception and self-deception. So the and so the deception is, I'm here because, you know, I've been oppressed, and therefore I have been handicapped, and that's why I haven't been able to compete, which is, of course, total bullshit. It's not true. The reason is that you're struggling with the competitive realities the way they actually are. And so now, because of that, there's a tool that we can pick up, because there's perverse incentives all over the damn culture to pick up that tool and to leverage it. And you know, we just put lifts in your shoe, just made you 3 inches taller, okay, is what we did. But you're not really 3 inches taller. And the and then people can know you're not 3 inches tall. Then it's this complete and total fiasco. So very interesting, you know. And then, you know, there's deceptive and self-deceptive processes that will pervade these kinds of situations. So wow, you know, what a mess human beings have made. What's that?
Yeah, it's a huge, huge mess, and there's really it's such catnip for energy conservation that
right.
we really can't pull ourselves out through willpower.
Right,
it's not like even if you can at the individual level, the sort of social tide is so strong that we're in for a lot more of the same, and it's just gonna get more and more sort of dysfunctional and counterproductive, and meritocracy is dead, et cetera.
So, yeah.
It almost seems like this came about just from increase in population. And in other words, so many people meant that people had to differentiate themselves so much more. And then this was born just out of a lot more people.
No.
Comes from wealth and ease. If people are hustling to get dinner that night and they're barely surviving, it doesn't matter how many of them are. Yeah, this is leisure offense.
Okay. Life is too good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this weaves its way back, and everything that we're talking about, as Jen said, that at some point you had well-meaning, misguided people looking at disparities that were becoming actually astounding under capitalism.
Yeah, and that were legitimate disparities.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the disparities, and then you could start to see that there was actually, you could delineate groups of people who were better off and worse off. And so now it's not just individuals. We're not talking about, you know, my uncle who went broke at his shoeshine thing versus Andrew Carnegie. Okay, and so now there's I talked about this, you know, in 2016 when we talked about communism versus capitalism, and mm-hmm. the fact that both of those sets of circuits sit inside every Stone Age brain. And so even though the fundamental reason why we have a communistic chip is for when food is scarce, that the village shares, that chip can get activated when something not dissimilar happens, which is that even though everybody's got food, the disparities in wealth become so graphic that it actually starts to tip something else, which is it's not survival, i.e. food, it is reproductive resources. So now you get almost unbelievable disparities in reproductively relevant resources. And now when that happens, it starts to activate a communist chip, i.e. this ought to be more even. Okay? And so now that's how you wind up with liberal thinking and liberal thought. And what will happen is that, as Jen corrected me on my point earlier today, she said, listen, this all starts off fine. It starts off with very good intentions. And it reminds me of... I'll never remember the affliction of the Roman consul, Lucius Cornelius Sulla, that he had this affliction that it's just a chronic itch.
The skin.
Yes. Yeah. And it's like it's an itch, and if you scratch it, he'd scratch himself till he bled. That's what messing with freedom and free enterprise is. You have well-meaning people like, hey, we just need to scratch this itch over here. Okay. It will be better if we do it this way. Okay. It will make it more fair. We're going to even it out. And the problem is you scratch that, and then pretty soon you scratch till the whole thing's bleeding. That's where we are now. Okay.
Well, and particularly as you say, because there is a resource boon behind that the founders did not necessarily intend. So there are really thoughtful kind of political philosophers who sort of look at this current state of affairs and they say the seeds of this are in the beginning of the whole idea, and that, you know, whether it's the paradox of tolerance or however people want to think about it, that the sort of as soon as you have a mind toward greater inclusivity and, you know, quote unquote fairness, that it does become this runaway process. I'm not so sure that it does if you're not in an environment where there is an abundant public coffer to draw from.
I agree.
And sort of that becomes its own engine.
Yes, it is.
it starts to sustain things, and the thing just gets too big in general and gets away from everybody. So you don't have the natural kind of checks on overdrawing the collective resources of a group that you would have in a Stone Age environment, where someone would say, okay, enough's enough. Like, you were having a hard time. We helped you out. Communist chip was activated. Now things have restored, and we're going to, you know, the pendulum's going to swing back. That gets completely out of whack when you have just a lot of artificial wealth on the table.
Yep. When $21 trillion is missing and nobody knows where it went.
And as we found out in COVID, nobody can do that. Yeah.
Yep.
All right.
Yep.
Well, I think that's about enough for one day. What do you think, Jen?
That was fascinating.
We got our 1913 rant in there.
What's that? We did.
We did.
Yeah, good. We slipped it in.
Yeah, it's good for us. We're good libertarians.
Yeah, that's good.
All right.
Well, all right, everybody.
Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, thank you so much. I learn something new every time, and this was no different. So really, really appreciate it. So thank you so much.
Fantastic, Nathan. Good job. And all right, Jen, we'll talk really soon.
Sounds good. All right, you guys have a good night.
Okay,
right,
gotcha. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.